assembly where we learn from each other and talk about issues of faith and life. Thanks to Roman Miller and Richard Bowman for the planning that they put into these monthly events of exchange. And welcome whether you're here for the first time or if you've some, as I look out across the audience, I see some who I always see when I'm here. My name is Eric Martin. I'm one of the chaplains here at VMRC, and it's my honor and privilege to welcome you to Elder Exchange. So after an opening prayer, then I'll turn it over to Roman Miller, who will introduce our speakers for this evening. So let us pray. Lord God, we thank you that we can gather as your people. Thank you for those you have brought to share with us this evening, their experiences, and we thank you for the minds and hearts and bodies you have given to each of us, and thank you that we can learn from each other's experiences. So give us openness of minds as we share, as we listen, as we dialogue this evening, and we pray that you might be honored by all that's said and done here. We pray all this through Christ. Amen.
Thank you, Eric. Again, also, I want to thank you for coming and being here tonight. Before I talk about this evening, I want to talk about the next forum. When you came in today or this evening, you should have received this flyer, Church and State in the Carolingian Era. And it's by Carol Shepherd, who is a professor from Bridgewater College. Just a brief comment about it. Today we live in a time where we often emphasize the separation of church and state. In this era that she's going to talk about is a joining of church and state. And so we can look at historically what happened, what are the benefits, what are the costs, and what are the liabilities. And I'm sure with the respondents, and I see at least one of them here tonight, we're going to make some references to our situations in our modern time also, because we always deal, what's the role of church in state, et cetera, et cetera. So come for that one, I think you will enjoy it. Gerald Brunk and Dean Welty will be the two respondents for that. The other document that you could get, if you didn't get it, there at the tables, it's a listing of our future forum through January. And in a month or so, we'll have a projected one that'll probably go through about March or April. But you can look at those and choose all of the ones that you want to come to, and hopefully there'll be a lot of them. At the bottom of that listing is a place that you can go to hear the audio recordings of many of the presentations. Like this one this evening is being recorded. If you want to hear it again, you go to that website that's at the bottom of the page, and that will allow you to listen to it as a podcast. And then finally, last month, we passed out some evaluation forms. I got very few of them back, but I did get a few. And if you are open to doing an evaluation and you haven't already done one, if you did one last month, don't do it again. But if you haven't done one, there are the tables at the back and at the side. Take one, take it home, drop it in campus mail to either Richard or myself. This evening, we are delighted to have as our primary guest speaker Harold F. Miller. A couple comments about Harold. He was born at a fairly early age in 1935, it says, and spent over 50 years of African experience. Part of that is because he married a woman who was almost African anyway, and so he had to kind of be there too. But I remember Harold and Annetta over the years when they would come back sometimes and I would see them in church meetings and that kind of a thing, talking about the African experience. Harold graduated from Eastern Mennonite College at that point, now university, got an MA in International Affairs from Pittsburgh University. He's been a fraternal staff member to several African Christian councils, MCC country rep during a bunch of that time in East Africa and Sudan. He retired in 2005, and they came to Virginia in 2018. And so we're delighted to have them in our community. Following his presentation, I will introduce the two respondents. After the two respondents share, then we'll have an open time with Q&A from the audience. Harold.
Let's welcome them.
Can you hear me? Is that okay? Good evening. How many of you have been to Africa? Wow. So there are at least that many Africans in existence. And this is another one. Because my perceptions are very subjective. I'm hesitant about hearing pronouncements and conclusions, because Africa is an ongoing project. Just a bit more about our going to Africa. After graduation, we both taught at EMHS for a little bit, for several years. And then my wife began to say it would be nice to go home sometime. And so that was one reason. And we applied to be teachers with the MCC TAP program. Somewhere along the way, we were sold to Eastern Mennonite Board of Missions. And they appointed me to be a fraternal worker with the Christian Council of Tanzania at that time. So I was there as a staff person. And then, as he said, in several other national councils of churches. And then for a 10-year period, I was with the All Africa Conference of Churches. Now, I should clarify that these organizations are within the ecumenical orbit, so like the World Council of Churches orbit. And they were comprised of the mainline churches. I'm talking about Presbyterians, Methodists, Anglicans, and a few others. So they were, as I'll mention later, they were variously aligned with the colonial powers. So that's the context. There are many, many other actors, churches of all kinds, but these were sort of establishment type missionary organizations. Before going further, I want to say something about this map. This is a huge place, by the way. It's about 5,000 miles from north to south, and about 4,000 miles east and west. It also contains the youngest country in the world. Does anybody know who that is? Which country that is?
South Sudan.
Harold.
Yes.
This is not my stick. South Sudan, right here. So this was a part of Sudan. Sudan became independent in 1956, and this country became independent in 2011. So that was after the main independence movement had passed along. If you're thinking, I will be hanging some of these ideas of my comments on dates this evening. So think in your mind, if you will, of the date 1884-85 to 2063, and I'll tell you why that becomes important after a while. Just a bit about this map. The distance I just told you, the population of Africa at the moment is about 1.2 billion at the moment. It's a huge place. The Christian population is 50.3%. And the Muslim population is 43%, so almost 50-50. with other minorities present as well, Asian minorities and so on. In about 1800, you could still talk about 2,000 languages on this continent. These languages come in about in sort of 5 or 6 major language groups, but think 2,000 languages, people groups across the continent, and in Africa, the languages and people groups tend to be place-oriented. That is to say, if you're on the northeast side of Mount Kenya, you're probably a Meru. And as it happens, since the whole independence story, you're also probably a Methodist because the church has divided out the country among themselves. So the languages are very much place-oriented. The vegetation, the climate, the foods that are possible informed the language. Now, if you think about it, we don't have that privilege. We're all imports, we're all immigrants, and we brought everything with us, including our language and our theology and everything. Here you have people who were in place for a very long time and developed their worldviews. Today, there are still remnants of these 2,000 languages all over the place, but today we have 4 languages on the continent: French, English, Portuguese, and Arabic. And until the First World War, we also had German. Germany lost its colonies in Africa in the First World War. And now there are 55 independent African countries. 55 independent African countries. And they are all members of an organization known as the African Union. It was originally called the Organization of African Unity. Now it's based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, right here. And Ethiopia, as you know, is mentioned in the Bible and well known to everyone. There are 3 countries. The 3 countries with the largest economies are South Africa and Egypt and Nigeria in the West. Then you also have regional trade unions, like you have in South Africa, you have SADC, East Africa, you have EAC, and West Africa, you have ECOWAS. These are trade areas where the countries in that circle trade with themselves. There's also one in Central Africa. As of about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the African Union has agreed to launch a continental trade organization. So for the first time since whenever, there will be an emphasis on intra-Africa trade. Now I'll be looking at several bits. I want to go through the church history of Africa, because my situation was church throughout, and my biases were formed by involvement with the church in various ways, and I looked at the continent from that bias. So I'm biased, I'm subjective in my observations. But the history of the church in Africa is very, very interesting. The oldest church in the world is, of course, the Coptic Church, Coptic Orthodox Church of Alexandria in Egypt. And it's still around. Egypt, up there, the purple one in the middle. Egypt, still today, has 10% of its people are Coptic Orthodox people to this day. It was established in about 61 or 67 AD. So it is been there from the, as it were, from the beginning. And in the first 200-300 years, that church was a movement of Jewish renewal. It slowly became more and more Christian, and eventually became a major, major place of theological reflection and philosophical reflection. The other old church in Africa is the Ethiopian Tawaheno Orthodox Church. The approximately 63% of Ethiopia today is Orthodox, very strong, very old. And it was established in about 330 AD. And the impulse from that came not from Egypt, it came from Lebanon, from the Middle East, by someone called Frumentius. Then you have the Nubian Church. Now, the Nubian Church is often, not very often talked about, because it was birthed, lived a long time, and then it died. Nubia is this area between the southern border of Egypt and the capital of Sudan. That is Nubia. Somewhere in there is where the Ethiopian eunuch had his experience. And even to this day, in northern Sudan, among the Muslim community, we met Muslim friends who told us that they have this story somewhere in their memory about the eunuch. They also have the story of Kandiki, Candace, in that area. That church was in existence from about 500 AD to about 1500 AD. In about 650 AD, the Arabs, who were then already in control of Egypt, remember the Muslim thing began in 620 thereabouts, and Egypt was one of the first areas to conquer, and then from there they came and made an attempt to invade Sudan. It is said that the Nubians were sharpshooters. They were called pupil smiters. So they had arrows, and they kept the Arabs off. And then there were negotiations, and the negotiations ended in an agreement called the Pact. And that pact was in existence for the next 600 years. And it prescribed the nature of the interaction, the travel, and the settlement of Arabs coming into Nubia. Well, as it happened, this 1,000-year-old Nubian church, it was quite strong for some years, and it was tied pretty much to three monarchies. So that may have been part of the problem, but eventually it slowly died out, and by 1500, and then the Arabs took over Sudan, and that area has been Islamic ever since. The other Islamic incursion, appearance on the African continent was right after Muhammad was established his prophecy, or himself as a prophet. And some of his disciples were persecuted. So they came to Ethiopia, and there they were received and protected by a Christian king. And that to this day is recognized by Islam vis-a-vis Ethiopia. So now I'm talking now about the religious history, church and the Christian church and Islam. In about the 9th century, you had jihads from Egypt down toward West Africa. And in the early days, those jihads aligned themselves with traditional old African kingdoms, and over time infiltrated and eventually became sort of strong Muslim empires. And one of these ended up in Mali, here, Mali. And in Timbuktu in Mali, there was this very, very famous university. And even to this day, the results, the writings of that university are very much treasured. Several years ago, sort of half dozen years ago, there was a major strike in Timbuktu, and many of the documents were destroyed. But they're trying to save as much as possible. Then along the East Africa coast, you had Islam already in the 8th century was appearing here, but not as jihad. It appeared as a trade movement from Oman, here, this country, right here, Omanis. They were great seafaring people. The Arabian dhow became very famous with them, and they came along here trading in general, but also in slaves. So eventually, and there were various slave trading organizations for a while in Sudan, here in Khartoum. That was a slave market, and various other places. But eventually, in the late 17th, early 1800s, the slave trade in East Africa had centered on Zanzibar. You see these two little spots right off the coast of Tanzania. That was the major slave market. And David Livingston, the High Church Anglican explorer, churchman, missionary in Africa, made a big fuss about slavery, talked about it in Britain. Out of that came the High Church Anglican University's mission to Central Africa. And they eventually took on the slave market, or the slave trade, and by about 1873 it was finally brought to a halt when the British government blockaded Zanzibar Island and brought it to a halt. But meanwhile, the Omanis had not only done trading, but they actually moved their jurisdiction to Zanzibar, and eventually the Sultanate family split, and one stayed behind in Oman, and the other one came to Zanzibar, and was overthrown in 1964, just a year after we arrived. So we just got the tail end of this long story. The other Christian presence in Africa was the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa. That was established in 1652, and is still there, of course. And the other Christian bit is here in Liberia, right here. That state was established in 1847 by freed American slaves who went back and settled there. The early settlers were all reverends, and they were all keen Christians, and it became a Christian outpost. So in 1900, there were the Muslims and Christians were minorities in Africa. They were just specks on the map. And there were about 8.7 million Christians in the continent at that time. That's about 1900. In 1910, there was the very famous Edinburgh Mission Conference, which led eventually to the formation of the World Council of Churches. And they were reviewing the previous 100 years of mission around the world and planning for more, of course, and eventually deciding what the follow-up postures would be. They opined at the time that Africans would not become Christians because they are followers of tribal animistic religions. As it turned out, between 1900 and the year 2000, over half of all Africans became Christians. That is to say, and at that time the population was 800 million. So let's say 400 million Africans became Christians in that 100-year period. And of course, after that, and already during that time, there were many mission organizations coming to Africa. As I mentioned, these mainline church missions were coming to Africa. And they were generally accompanying the colonial governments. So I should mention also that, one thing I forgot here. These borders were lined out in 1884-85 when the European countries got together in Berlin, Germany, and decided to separate, to allocate Africa to themselves. And this was the result. And when independence came in the 60s, Africa said, look, it would just be too much of a hassle to try to sort this all out. So those boundaries have stayed to this day. They have been not changed at all, really, except for the new country of South Sudan. So during the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was very heavy church growth in Africa, and the mainline churches became very deeply involved in the provision of healthcare, hospitals, and in education. And of course, they collaborated among themselves for Bible translation and distribution. And in the process, the churches, as I mentioned before, the churches had divided Africa among themselves. So if you're in Kenya, you sit together as mission agencies and you divvy these out. Process is called comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, I didn't know that word. It had to do with separating out our goodies to everyone's satisfaction. So that's what happened then. So we had, that effort to collaborate on the provision of those services, health and education, eventually were called missionary fellowships. Those missionary fellowships became national Christian councils in Africa, and today there are 30 such national Christian councils in the 55 countries. 24 of those national councils are affiliated with the All Africa Conference of Churches. And I'll be taking, I'm just moving down to the year 1963, and then continue a bit later on with the church. In 1963, these churches, now that had formed Christian councils, mainline churches across Africa, they got together on a continental basis and they established the All Africa Conference of Churches. So it's a continental Protestant ecumenical organization based in Nairobi, Kenya. Now let me back up a little bit and take follow the progress of political development in Africa. I already mentioned some of the jihads of early on. But from 1400 to 1800, Africa was looted by slavery, by the slave trade, and other kinds of looting as well. It is estimated that something like 11 million, some figures up to 25 million Africans were extracted from the continent and brought primarily to southern Africa, to southern South America, to the Caribbean, and about 500,000 here, according to the statistics I have. It was a massive, massive operation, and as you know, a horrific operation. This went on until and as I mentioned, Livingston was one of the people who brought and I should say that there were two slave traditions. One was the Christian slave tradition based in West Africa, and this was called the triangular slave trade. So you went from, the ships went from Britain with the trinkets and goodies down to West Africa, distributed those to chiefs who had collected slaves for sale. Slaves were then sent to the Western Hemisphere, and then sugar and other products brought back. So that became the triangular slave trade, and it was the Christian slave trade. On this side, you had what I already mentioned, the Muslim slave trade, and that trade reached far into the Middle East, as far as India and China and Turkey and Iraq. You had, and all over the Indian Ocean islands, from the Zanzibar slave trade. Then in 1884-85, the European powers got together. These were Germany, France, Spain was there, Belgium, England, and they divided the place up like this, except for two countries, Ethiopia and Liberia. Those were the only two countries that didn't fall under the colonial powers. In the late 1800s, there were already stirrings for independence in Africa. And these stirrings were taking shape in Afro-Caribbean circles. So these were African descendants living in the Caribbean, down between here and South America. These were well-educated ideologues who said it's not good that Africa is under the colonial powers. So in 1900, these people got together with some select African nationalists, and they held a series of congresses. The first one in 1900, and then up until 1945. They had, I think, five major congresses. They were called Pan-Africanist congresses. And the idea was to plan for the decolonization of Africa. And they picked and chose nationalists from Africa. And these nationalists, many of them, were also not necessarily Christian, but they were church educated, because the missionaries had been in work, they had had their schools, and out of that came the new elite. Some of them went into politics, into independence politics, and some went to church. So there was a kind of an acquaintance between these major actors. In 1957, you then had the first sub-Saharan African independent country, that was Ghana. And then in 1963, you had the Organization of African Unity coming together in Addis Ababa. And this was an initiative by the then independent countries in Africa, 1963. We arrived in Dar es Salaam in 1965. So we arrived midstream in a large process. Already many, many African countries, French African countries, French-controlled colonies and others had become independent. But in 1963, in Dar es Salaam, there was something called the OAU Liberation Committee. And that committee was established by the African Union, well then by the Organization of African Unity. And it was chaired by President Nyerere of Tanzania, who, by the way, was a very keen Catholic Christian, actually something of an intellectual. Just by the way, after he retired, he translated the four Gospels and the Book of Acts into poetic Swahili poems, as it were. Very fantastic man. He had wanted to be a priest, but his friends said, no, you do better as a politician. So we were plopped right into the middle of this thing, and in the Christian Council where I worked, we had a whole, in fact in my department, we had a lot of contact with the whole liberation story. This attempt to undo the colonial thing. And Dar es Salaam was by then a haven for all kinds of representatives from these countries into the south that were not yet independent. And these countries were seen to be problematic because they had very unusual histories. Now let me just explain a few bits. The countries, the country of Mozambique and Angola and Guinea-Bissau over in the west were Portuguese territories or departments. They were not colonies. So they were deemed by Portugal to be a part of Portugal. Therefore, the question of freedom didn't arise for them. South Africa, as you know, was settled by those whites in 1652. And over the next several centuries, there were various configurations of governments, but always the whites in charge. So that was very, very difficult. This was called Southwest Africa at that time. And interestingly, even though everyone recognized South Africa as a problematic country, and it was actually a member of the United Nations, but there were problems because of their segregationist policies. But at that time, South Africa was the custodian of UN trustee territories. Southwest Africa had been German, and in the First World War, the Germans lost, of course, and at that point became a trustee territory of the League of Nations, and then later of the United Nations. As eventually Southwest Africa then became Namibia as a free country. And during this time, we were hearing President Nyerere say, you know, we're in a dramatic, dynamic change process, and everything right now is priority. So we have felt this tension with the future coming in on us. The other country that was interesting was what is now Zimbabwe. At that time it was called Rhodesia, and Rhodesia since the 1920s had been governed by a white minority, a European white minority group, with permission from the British government. And then, within the first year of our presence in Dar es Salaam, I was in a meeting of the Christian Council, and we were all aware of the tensions in Zimbabwe. While we were meeting, the local Anglican Australian bishop sticks his head in the door and says, "Universal Declaration of Independence has been declared in Rhodesia." And the whole place went into shock, because we were sort of anticipating that. And that meant that this group of whites who were controlling Rhodesia had now declared themselves independent for Britain. So they were on their own, 250,000 people in Rhodesia controlling the whole country. So this was a major setback, and that arrangement stayed in place for the next 15 years. And a series of armed conflicts designed to free the various countries from colonialism were then underway in the Portuguese areas Botswana was more benign, but certainly in Mozambique and Angola there were these armed wars going on. Then in 19 and one thing I'm forgetting here, along the way after 1963, somewhere in the orbit of the ecumenical movement, the African church leaders decided that South Africa needed very special attention because of its segregationist government. So they fingered Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and said, "You will be our point person. You will go there and you will stay there until that South African problem is solved." And Tutu said, "You don't know what you're asking. It's a very complicated situation." He said, no, "You do what we say." And so he stuck with it. In 1990, Tutu was present when Nelson Mandela came out of prison. And he was present, of course, in 1994 when Mandela became the first African president of South Africa. Very shortly thereafter, Nelson Mandela, as president then, initiated something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he asked Tutu to be the chair of that commission, which he undertook. It was a very traumatic experience, reliving, undoing the past of South Africa, of segregationist South Africa. Out of that experience, there were two major words, a phrase and a word. Tutu wrote a book titled No Future Without Forgiveness. And by the way, it's a very important and a good read. The other word that came out of South Africa from that experience was Tutu's choice of the word Ubuntu. Ubuntu means humanness. And the word appears in all kinds of Bantu languages. In Swahili, what we spoke, it was Utu. It just means that we are human, and the phrase, "I am because we are because I am," this communalist understanding, was really what Ubuntu was all about. It just happened that earlier on, within the last about three, 4 years, the leaders of the Organization of African Union now came to the All Africa Conference of Churches and said, look, both of our organizations were established in 1963. In the year 2063, we will both be celebrating our centenaries. Let's think ahead to that time, and let's think about where the continent might go by that time. Why don't you, as All Africa Conference of Churches, give thought over the next decades to the whole idea of a continental ethics for the continent? So as a consequence, the All Africa Conference of Churches has now convened a series of meetings calling together Muslims, Christians of all denominations, including traditional believers, Hindus, Sikhs, everyone, Jews, and they talk about this continental ethic, hoping that by 2063 there might be some idea of how we live together well on the African continent. And that's underway at the moment. Losing my point here. Yes, I wanted now after that to, well, let me say, yeah, I should say this as well. After 1963, the African Union and the All Africa Conference of Churches worked together very considerably on all kinds of projects. And the liberation of Southern Africa, especially South Africa, became a central concern, especially of the All Africa Conference of Churches, but even the Tanzanian Council of Churches where I was working. This became an obsession. And you might remember that there was solidarity from around the world against the South African government. The other huge dynamic at that time was the fact that we were in the middle of the Cold War. And these liberation groups, you typically, let's say from Angola or Namibia, the liberation groups that came to Dar es Salaam pleading for recognition with the Liberation Committee of the AU, they were divided. Some of them were supported by the Soviet Union, and others were supported by the West. So we were caught very heavily in that whole debate. And you couldn't, and Africa became a political pawn internationally in that sense. And in some measure, the churches got caught up in that. It was seen that because like the World Council of Churches was very much in favor of independence in Africa and took a left of center position, they were often seen to be radical left and almost identified with positions taken by the Soviet Union. So, and countries in the West were critical of the World Council of Churches, and so there was a tension at work at that time. Just a few comments now about sort of concluding remarks. In one of the meetings we had in the All Africa Conference of Churches, I worked there for 10 years, and during that 10 years, Tutu was our chair. And one of the meetings, he said, you know what? We've been using the language of going from Egypt to Canaan for all these years as we worked for independence from colonialism. With Nelson Mandela out of prison, and now as president of South Africa, we are already in Canaan, and we don't have words for it. We don't have language for it. So let's think about that. And so in that meeting, one of my theologian friends was asked to think about that, thought about it for quite some time, and came up with the idea of reconstruction, and he based it on the book of Nehemiah. After Babylon rebuilding and all that. That became a theme, and that, by the way, is being discussed among academic theologians at the moment, ongoing. The other question that I always struggled with and I always found fascinating was, why did Africa say yes to gospel? What was that all about? Where did that come from? And I heard various answers, and some of them were very interesting to me. They said, you know, when we read the Bible, we see ourselves there. Our culture, many of our practices, our understandings are there. We understand what's going on. Since we're there, and since we're real and true, the Bible must be true. So that was one thing I heard repeatedly. The other comment I heard repeatedly was that as soon as, this was not said by Laman Sene, but Laman Sene just died recently, a very famous theologian from the Gambia teaching at Princeton. He used to say that as soon as the Bible was translated into local languages, the missionaries lost control. And the locals simply followed as they saw fit, informed by their cultures. The other thing that happened, in parallel to the whole missionary story, was the reflection on and development of what is now called African religion. And one of the champions of that was a theologian in Kenya by the name of John Mbiti, very famous African Christian theologian. And he said, look, this African understanding of spirituality is not just any old how. It is, you can organize this into rational thinking. What you've been talking with and talking about is in fact African religion. And that is now documented, it's there, you can read it, it's part of the story. Then there was something called African Christian theology, and that was heavily informed by a conversation with the indigenous traditions of various kinds. There was also something called Black theology. That was informed by the theology of James Cone, the African-American, and by liberation theology from South Africa, and was championed by theologians in South Africa who were more militant in their posture vis-a-vis the whites. And then, of course, you have a very broad spectrum of evangelical theology underway even now in Africa. And now, in recent years, you have widespread Pentecostalism in Africa. It is probably the most important current dynamic is Pentecostalism. And among the players in that arena are very powerful Africans. There are people in Nigeria who are they're into prosperity gospel, they are rich, they have mega churches, they have private jets, they have stations across Africa, they have churches in Britain. One of the largest congregations on a Sunday morning in Britain is one of their African churches. So the scene has changed absolutely dramatically. Just one more thing. I would just point out that with internet and technology, young Africans are looking at Google just like you. The whole world is right there. And young people are saying, look, one of my Kenyan friends who's a theologian, he teaches at the Jesuit University. And he says, his students are saying, yes, we're Africans, but when he tries to situate them into the African culture, African cosmology, say, no, wait. We're now the internet. We are as smart as those guys in the West. We're thinking the same thoughts. Don't confuse us with this back stuff. He said sometimes by the end of the semester, some of them would say, yes, it's okay to be African and to celebrate that, but that is increasingly difficult. And I could also say, I suspect that if you would ask a teenager about 10, 12 years old at this moment, whether he or she knows anything about what I've said this evening, they would say, that's bullshit, don't know about it.
For this tour over time. We're going to have two respondents. The first one, Edith Shank Koontz, former EMM African missionary. Edith tells me that she was there with her husband, Joe, for over 20 years, primarily in leadership training, primarily in Tanzania. And some of us know also that Edith and Joe came back here and were pastors at Weaver's Mennonite for about 18 years. And so she has considerable African experience and other church leadership experience. Edith is going to come first to share her reflections. Following that, Susan Godshall, who is retired chaplain. She has been a chaplain at Phil Haven for quite a few years. She also has been in Africa over several occasions involving teaching English in, again, Tanzania. I didn't know I had two Tanzanians when I was recruiting these people. She taught English to nurses in Tanzania and also represented EMM in Africa at several times. So we're going to have those two people come and respond, and then following that, we'll have Q&A from the audience.
What I would like to speak about is what it was like to live in East Africa through some of the changes in the 1900s. So bear with me. My first husband, Joseph Shank, and I lived and worked in East Africa for 20 years. We worked for Eastern Mennonite Missions and Mennonite Central Committee, both organizations home-based in Eastern Pennsylvania. There was quite a large contingent of mission workers there during those years, and Harold was among them. He and Joe were friends, and whenever our families got together, which wasn't really often because we were serving in two different countries, we spent hours listening to Harold's wisdom. Being a second generation missionary family had advantages of learning the history of the land and the people and of the mission and church. When the Mennonite mission first went to Tanganyika in the early 1930s, other groups like the Lutherans, the Moravians, and the mission organization called the Africa Inland Mission, plus others like the Methodists, had been given their territories or sections of the country to evangelize. Those areas had large tribal groups. But the people, the white people in the government of Tanganyika at that time said, "There is an area near Lake Victoria that has many small tribes and has not been assigned to any mission agency. You may go to Mara region." It's a region which borders Lake Victoria in the northwest corner of the country. There are at least five tribal groups that I can name quickly, and several smaller ones tucked away here and there. Swahili is the Arabic-influenced trade language of the country, but working in Mara region had its difficulties because many of its people, back when the mission began, were using mostly their tribal languages. Beginning work of developing schools and providing medical care meant a heavy emphasis on learning and teaching Swahili. As we settled into mission work in the early 1960s in the then named country of Tanganyika, which now East Africa is considered the three countries of Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, the light blue, the medium blue, and the purple. When we went in the early 1960s, colonialism was still evident. There were still white Europeans in charge of government offices and businesses. Think of the movie Out of Africa, and you have a bit of a snapshot. White people were still in charge and very much in evidence, with Africans being the workers and servants in their own country. When we first arrived in East Africa, which comprised the three countries that I mentioned, Uganda, Kenya, and Tanganyika, the currency was usable in all three countries and had the image of Queen Elizabeth on all of its bills and coins. When independence came, the currency changed to one that was also usable in all three countries, but the Queen had disappeared. Soon, each nation decided its country needed the image of its leader on the currency, and they decided on a variety of values for each country's currency. Fortunately, all currencies were based on the shilling, and that saved us some headaches. In the 20 years we lived in East Africa, we went from interchangeable currencies to money good in only one of the three East African countries. That was one of the practical inconveniences of living in a newly minted country. And postal stamps went through a similar revolution. Beside that, we changed from pounds and ounces to kilograms and liters, from miles to kilometers, from inches and yards to millimeters and meters, and we survived. As we listened to Africans reflect on the colonial history of Tanzania, we heard them speak with awe of the Germans, who had been there until World War I. They could really build roads, and where they did, they were straight. Yes, they were straight. You could stand and look down on them and see that they were very straight. Occasionally, we would find an older Tanzanian who remembered a few German words, and he would proudly recite them. Another very interesting fact we learned was about their beloved mountain, Kilimanjaro. It is known that back in the days of German rule in Tanganyika, that this special mountain was in Kenya, and that Kenya had two snow-capped mountains within its borders. But one year, back in Europe, among the powers that had originally drawn the borders of African countries, some of the rulers were having a birthday party. And one ruler decided that since a German cousin didn't have a snow-capped mountain in his country, that for a birthday gift, he would change the border between the two countries and give Kilimanjaro to him. Thus, Kilimanjaro came to be within the borders of Tanganyika. I've been talking a lot about Tanganyika, but the country became Tanzania in 1964, when the island of Zanzibar was added to it. Tanganyika had become independent from England in 1961. While living there, we saw changes in currency, in the national flag, in the government, as well as a developing pride in who the people were as citizens of their own country. Independence in the country birthed the desire for independence within the Mennonite Church, which up until that time had been administered by white missionaries. Careful changes were worked at, and African men were ordained as bishops. That created some stressful spaces for missionaries, but gave rise to a sense of ownership to the local people. Today, missionaries work in programs in conjunction with Africans, and the local church is thriving under the leadership of qualified, trained local leaders. Generally, the Mennonite Church of Tanzania, or in Swahili, Kanisa la Mennonite Tanzania, is very aware of other denominations and the Council of Churches of its home country. Quite a few years ago, probably 40-some, the church sent my husband Joe to be on a committee of church leaders from across Tanzania to develop a curriculum for teaching religion in the government schools. They worked on making it fair for all religious groups and for a variety of ages. It was an intense labor of interfaith cooperation. To close, I'll tell you something about Harold Miller. Something that Harold Miller hasn't told you is that he is a lover of trees. And there is a divided highway near the place they lived for many years that is a lovely greenway because he spent years planting trees in the median.
200?
Good. He may know something about nearly every kind of tree that grows in Kenya. He expounded at length about the discovery that there is one kind of tree that doesn't germinate until the seeds have passed through the digestive system of an elephant. A man who loves trees and works for the church is to be listened to. And as he started to speak, I was reminded of a saying that I feel.
We do the names of Harold and Annetta Miller and Joe and Edith Shank, and looked up to them as mentors who were able to teach us. We came without any orientation or language training, and so we had lots to learn, and found that we were learning as long as we were there, and I think there were still some things we didn't learn. Stan and I lived in Tanzania for 4 years between 1979 and 85. We did a year, 3 months, and then came back for another couple of years with our children, our three children. And then later in 95, 96, we returned for 1 year and worked again all three times at Shirati Hospital in the northern edge of Tanzania along the lake. Stan did medical work. As Roman said, I did some teaching. Then in 1996 to 2000, I had the privilege of working with Eastern Mennonite Missions as representing their representative to Africa, which included working with the churches and mission personnel in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Tanzania, and also with placing teachers in the government schools in Djibouti, and doing a bit of relief education, supporting a bit of relief and education effort in Somalia, where it was no longer safe to have expatriate personnel. When we arrived in Tanzania, we had actually spent 2 weeks in Nairobi, which was a hard thing to do because we had to wait for a flight to get us across a closed border from Kenya to Tanzania. Flights could get permission to go in, but you could not go overland. When we landed in Mwanza, the distinct thing we both remember that the pilot said to us, when Stan pulled out his camera, and he always takes pictures, to take pictures, the pilot said, "No, no, put it away. This is a communist country." In fact, it was not a communist country. It had a socialist government because the first president, Nyerere, was very concerned about the well-being of all the people. As Harold noted, in the late 1800s and Edith II, the European powers divided up the continent of Africa. We lived right close, within an hour's drive by the official roads, an hour's drive to the Kenya border. And the people among whom we lived were Luos, predominantly Luos. They had many, many relatives and tribal fellows and sisters in Kenya, because one of the borders that the Europeans, when they drew borders, they didn't care about ethnic groups, they just went through particular regions. And so Luo folks that we knew had to cross a border to visit extended family and folks that they had known in previous years. And at the time of independence, I recall hearing people say they had to decide, they had moved around back and forth a lot with cattle herding and such, and they had to decide which country they would be part of. I have a few questions for Harold, and then I'll go on and make a couple of other random comments. And I'd just like to thank both Harold and Edith for your comments, very insightful. And these are the questions, Harold. 2019, and over the last couple of decades, we have the benefit of hindsight to critique Western Christian mission efforts in Africa. And I'm wondering, how did Western Christian missionary efforts influence the development not only of churches in Africa, but the development of Africa? In what ways were they beneficial or otherwise? Another question, an ongoing question for Western agencies, whether they are church or secular, is how to share resources with developing countries who are much poorer economically without creating dependency. And what counsel do you have for that question? Another question, in your understanding, what would Christian, African Christians and African Christian theologians want we in this country or the Northwest to understand about their perspective on Christian faith? So just a couple of questions to throw out there to get started. Harold gave us a lot of dates, and I'm going to give you a few more just to give you a little picture of the dates of Mennonite work in Eastern Africa, which is the part of Africa I know. I didn't count on the Mennonite World Conference webpage, but they have a wonderful map that you can just click on maps, and you'll see the distribution of Mennonite churches, and I think that would be member churches of Mennonite World Conference across the world, including Africa. And I believe African Mennonite churches make up about 35-36% of worldwide Mennonites. And that would be, there would be large numbers in Ethiopia, in Congo, and a bunch of West African countries. And the lists are all there if you want to check the website sometime. Edith referred to Eastern Mennonite Board sending missionaries in the early 30s. And they started with evangelism, but it soon became evident that medical work was needed and education was needed. And just a few statistics on that. In 1934 is when missionaries first went, Mennonite missionaries first went. 1936, Dr. Lily Shank went to Shirati to provide medical care, not for the missionaries was the intent, but how can you do medical work just for missionaries? She had medical work coming to her door daily. In 1939, Dr. Merle Eshelman joined the medical work in Tanzania, and many of you would remember who Dr. Merle Eshelman is. In 1942, because of Luo family connections, evangelism efforts began from Tanzania, primarily for Tanzanian members of the church, into Kenya, which was, as I said, not far away. And in regard to education, by the mid-60s, Mennonites had started 35 primary schools and 4 secondary schools in Tanzania. And Anetta's mother was, what, headmistress of one of those secondary schools, Musoma Alliance, was it?
Okay.
Also, on the question of independence, Harold talked about the early 1960s being a time when there was a lot of change happening. It was in 1961 that the Eastern Mennonite Mission Board recognized the Tanzania Mennonite Church as a national church entity, although the ongoing bishop was still an American for the next number of years. And it was a year later than in 1962 when Tanzania gained independence from Britain through efforts of Julius Nyerere, a very fine first president. And then several years later, 1967, Zedekiah Kisadi was ordained as the first Tanzanian bishop in Tanzania. Just a little parallel, Ethiopia and Kenya would be the other Mennonite churches that I'm familiar with in Africa. And Ethiopia, you've seen where those countries are, Ethiopia, it Tanzania. Mission work began in 1945 in Ethiopia. In 1960, and I see Carl and Vera Hansen here, so correct me if I have the dates wrong. In 1960, EMM recognized Misericordia Christus Church as the official national church in that country. 1964, Milion Belete, who became the first Ethiopian chairman of the church's national council, and he was ordained as the first Ethiopian pastor. He too, I believe, was the first president of Mennonite World Conference. Is that correct? I think so. First African president of Mennonite World Conference. And then Kenya, the mission efforts from Tanzanians to Kenya in 1942. That became difficult in 1977 to 1983 when the border was totally closed between Tanzania and Kenya. And so the Tanzanians who were still overseeing the churches in Kenya couldn't really travel back and forth very well. And so there was a lot of ferment, of course, by Kenyan churches to say, we are our own country, we need our own organization. And so that was recognized in, I think, 1985. The first bishops there were Bishop Musa Adongo, whose daughter Rebecca Osiro is currently in leadership in Mennonite World Conference, and also Bishop Joshua Okelo. Maybe one more observation about Tanzania's first president. As Harold said, he attended Catholic schools and was a lifelong Catholic. He led Tanzania to independence with enormous wisdom and skill, and it was a peaceful change of power. And I always felt when we lived in Tanzania, there was a kind of peacefulness in the countryside. And we would travel to Kenya for shopping and for children's education, and I always remember it seemed more tense there. Now the Millers may not have noticed that, but it was always, and I think it had a lot to do with the way Nyerere brought independence to that country. He sought to unite the country by public education for all children using the Swahili language. And although the tribal languages were still commonly used, and anyone who had not gone to primary education spoke mostly the tribal languages back in the 70s, but Swahili became a common denominator to bring 121 tribal groups in Tanzania together and bond them as a country, as a nation. The other thing is, he avoided the trappings of power. He had a country home where he was born, not too far from near the Mennonite work in Musoma, Tanzania. And he refused to have the road that led out to his family village paved. Most of the roads in that area were dirt roads. There were several paved roads, but not many. And he refused until the time of his death to have that road paved. So at the time of his funeral in 1999, dignitaries from all over Africa, thousands of people who gathered to that home village compound quietly to attend his funeral, they all traveled over what was a dusty road, or during the rains was a muddy road. He was the first president in Africa to step down voluntarily from power, and he still remained part of the party and was chairman of his political party, but he stepped aside to allow the way for new leaders to be elected. And the country of Tanzania has been peaceful in a way that I think may not be matched in other parts of Africa. I think I've covered my notes, and now I guess it's time for questions. Thank you.
Testing. Okay, this is on. While the table is being moved, we're going to come by and ask questions, or have you a chance to ask questions. I want to make a mention that Harold has some books that are available. You can buy them on Amazon. I'm going to lay them on the side table if you want to take a quick look at them as you leave. The first one is Reflections in Africa. Another one, Encounters in Africa, and then finally one more that has about talks about various murals in Africa. And you'll find a lot of sociology, some economics, political science, and some religion in all of these books. And so you'd be welcome to purchase these online. You have to go to Amazon. And if the speakers would take their places at the table, that would just really be great. And we'll start here in just one jiffy. Where's the other mic?
Oh, here.
Oh, you got it. Okay.
Is it on? No, it's not.
Test.
I think it had been on.
Do you want to turn the other mic on? This one's not. Yes, it's on. They're both on. Yeah, this one. Okay. What are your questions? I would ask you, when you ask, we have a few minutes, we don't have a lot of time. Keep your questions fairly brief. Please identify yourself, because this is audio recording, so we know who's asking the given question. Let's start over here. Anyone here have a question in this area? I'm going to move across. Anyone here have a question? You can ask it to any particular one on the panel, or just a general question. A question over here, okay? Please identify yourself and you can ask the question.
I'm Myron Augsburger. I was only a visitor over there, and I remember talking to national leaders in the church and told them I'm in education, so I was interested in what they thought we ought to be emphasizing. Their answer was, so that the people you sent here don't come trying to be in control, but to be partners. Does that make sense from where you all are?
Okay, you all want to comment about that? A couple of you at least. Harold, why don't you start?
Can I hear it?
Yes, you can. You're on.
Yes, that's a very real issue. And this was addressed in significant ways by the East African Revival Movement, which I did not mention. The East African Revival Movement began in the 30s, and it broke down barriers between missionaries and Africans in a remarkable way across denominations all over the place. And now I had the privilege of listening to sort of second, third generation people after, the children of revivalists. And what they're saying is that that revival movement provided a way for a peaceful transfer of leadership from missionaries to Africans. Whereas in the political scene, you had armed conflict, you had all kinds of struggles for a long time. So yes, very, very real.
Okay, other questions? Just raise your hand and okay, right here, then I'll be there.
John Asa Hertzworth. I know a lot of Anabaptists, Mennonites, or Church of the Brethren, Mennonite Brethren have multiplied in Africa a whole lot. My question is, the teaching of nonviolence and peace building, and seeing peace as an integral part of the gospel rather than an add-on, how is things going in Africa that way?
Why don't one of the respondents pick that up first, and then Harold?
Many of you remember Christopher Ndege, who did his internship here at this institution. And that was one of his, one of the things that he really wants to do when he's back in Africa. He has worked on a curriculum and a way to teach peace in the African church.
Susan, you have a comment yet on that?
I think the emphasis on peacemaking or non-military involvement in the churches in Tanzania, Kenya, and Ethiopia had a slow start, partly because they were trying to get churches started. Many of these countries, military service was obligated, and so it was a hard thing to teach, and I think they're catching up. EMU's program here, NMCC's efforts have been a great help in teaching the peace position.
And just a quick comment from the Circles Beyond Mennonites. All African people groups have some kind of a peace tradition. And in some cases, they were very elaborate. So for example, in northern Uganda, you had something called the Mato Oput, which was a peace-making system after conflict. And that was embraced by both traditional leaders, by political leaders, and by African bishops, and solved many of their issues on that basis. But in general, and this is one of the problems, this is one of the big, I didn't get to that this evening, but one of the big issues that remains unresolved is what to do with the tradition, even the best of traditions. To what extent can they be baptized and rendered Christian, as it were, because they were good traditions, but so much of the missionary emphasis tended to ask people to leave that whole tradition without ways of engaging with it. Now, since, and just a quick, I just recently read that book written by African theologians since all of what I talked about has happened. And what they're talking about is so very different from what I know. They're already talking about a completely different kind of engagement with their own tradition and with traditions from elsewhere.
Dennis Coons. Several years ago, I read an article by Philip Jenkins from Baylor University, in which he was projecting that it would not be too long before Christianity would be a religion of the southern hemisphere, yeah, rather than northern. That churches were growing so fast in Latin America and Africa that after a while Christianity would be known as a southern hemisphere religion rather than a North European. Any observations on that?
That's already true. That's already happening. Africa is just a major Christian happening, a major Christian conversation at many levels. Theologically, I didn't get to mention this, but there's just a string of very, very strong theological writings, theologians who have kept the conversation going in remarkable ways. And I think we have much to learn from that conversation.
Rhoda Searcy, and this is an economic question. What do you know about the role that China is playing in the economic development?
Go ahead.
I would just make a quick note and then pass it to Harold that in about 1982, we bought spoons made in China when we were living in Tanzania, and that was a new thing. So China was already selling things in the early 80s.
Yeah, China is big in Africa. And it will very soon be the largest trading partner with Africa. It is overtaking many economic processes in Africa. In Kenya, for example, they were building most all of the roads. Very, very powerful. And the West is complaining about that. So yeah, it's a very, very big thing. And just recently, I read an article about Chinese in Nairobi, Chinese workers in Nairobi. Interestingly, there were Christians among those Chinese working in Nairobi, and some of them were members of the underground church, and they were underground in Nairobi as well, even though they were known as Chinese. Others were members of the formal church in China, and they were okay as well. So they're all, everything's there. It's all happening.
Joe Lapp. I'm interested in how Christian theology is developing, and is there some coalescing of it so that denominationalism is threatened or is will be more or less done away with if there's more of a common Christian theology? And then secondly, I'm more interested in this plan for 2065?
63.
And what are the implications, what are some of the implications that you see that you haven't been able to talk about for that plan as it develops?
The nature of the engagement between churches and government has been problematic over the years. Sometimes they were colleagues, sometimes they were antagonistic. But they have improved over the years, I would say. Between the denominations, the theologizing that went on was not an attempt until now to narrow those gaps. The theology was much more in communication with the past, with the tradition. That was the debate. How do we deal with our African past? Like, where did our conscious and unconscious yes come from? How is that situated in this society? And that was a common problem to all Christian churches. The denominational thing, that was used for certain purposes, for some overseas money, from whatever else, but that was not the primary concern.
Okay, I think time does fleet, and so we will stop with that, except I've asked Anita to share some African wisdom yet with us as a parting message.
Well, as a wife of somebody who plants trees, I will leave you with an African proverb that says, "Hills with trees are footsteps of God."
All right.
On your way out, don't forget there are some handouts if you didn't pick them up on the way in. Also, in the front table, you can note the titles of the books of Harold F. Miller. Thank you again. God bless you. And we'll see you next month, God willing. And we'll talk about church and state.